Thank you, Kate. That was awesome. Next, we have Joe Osbaker, who was one of the key organizers of the NATO protests in 2012. He is a leading member of the Anti-War Committee Chicago and a steward with SEIU. He has been raided by the FBI for his anti-war activities, and so that gives him a little bit of infamy. As an anti-war activist, he's been interviewed by pretty much every local station multiple times, as well as national and international news service stations, from Fox News to Press TV. Anyone who has organized with Joe can attest not only to his friendly and affable nature, but also his dedication and determination to build an anti-war movement. So, welcome Joe Osbaker.
Thank you, Holly. I also want to point out that of the three people that coordinated the local mobilization, Pat Hunt is the second of the triumvirate, so sitting here to my left. So I'm going to talk about, I don't know how to entitle this. Somebody once wrote a book called Imperialism and War, so I think I'll just use that title, just borrow that one. So at the start of this month, the beginning of September, the whole world was tense, on edge, as the U.S. proclaimed that it was going to start missile strikes against Syria. It seemed likely to most observers that the war wouldn't be 2 or 3 days, but like the war in Kosovo or like the 98 bombing against Iraq, that it would go on for several months. And the generals were promising us that it would cause more deaths and destruction than 2.5 years of efforts of the Free Syrian Army. And then Russia proposed a diplomatic solution to take Syria's chemical weapons, and I don't know if I can't speak for everyone, but to my great surprise, the U.S. government accepted it. But then John Kerry said that the U.S. would go along with putting Syria's weapons under international control only if there was the threat of force in a U.N. resolution. But then this last Friday, the U.S. had to back down on getting the U.N. Security Council resolution on eliminating Syrian chemical weapons. They had to drop the threat of force if Syria doesn't comply. So stepping back, we can see that for 2.5 years, the U.S. has funded and directed the forces to intervene with the Gulf Coordination Council, with Israel and NATO. You know, Turkey is part of NATO, playing roles. On the other hand, the U.S. has refused direct military intervention, you know, bombing or invasion. So what explains these contradictions, and why the back and forth? Why the sudden reversals? Why couldn't the U.S., the most powerful military might ever on the planet, carry out this war on this small nation? It's a contradiction. There are some other things going on in Syria that also seem contradictory. So, as I said, the U.S. has spent 2.5 years funding this armed attack on the Syrian government and the people of Syria, the largest number of deaths, by the way, contrary to most of the Western media. The largest number of deaths have been caused not by the forces of the Syrian government, its army and militia. The largest number of deaths have been caused by the combatants armed by the Gulf Coordinating Council and backed by the U.S., the U.S. has been doing this ever since the Arab Spring in 2011. The moment there was a mass protest movement in Syria against, you have to recognize it, that mass movement was protesting unpopular policies of neoliberalism, opening the Syrian economy to world finance, and the resulting austerity measures. There were some legitimate grievances in that. But the moment that happened, the U.S. began to make its move. They armed the only forces that they could find inside of Syria and sent in, at this point, according to the Russians, 40,000 foreign fighters, many of whom are aligned with the Salafist movement, such as the Al-Nusra Front and other Al-Qaeda-linked groups. By the way, this week we also learned that the moderates that John McCain met with when he was over there, they had a press conference in which they said that they're going to quit the puppet Free Syrian Army because it's what it is, and they called it that. And instead, they're going to join forces with al-Nusra and form an Islamic front instead. But then, in the this week's issue of Foreign Policy magazine, the most influential publication on that topic in Washington, the editors put out that they think Assad will go and be replaced by the former defense minister, a guy by the name of Ali Habib. This article reflects thinking in the White House about how to resolve the Syrian conflict, as well as the worries in Washington and Israel that the sectarian, foreign-led, and dominated armies aligned with al-Qaeda would come to power if the U.S. and Israel succeeded in forcing out Assad. So how come the U.S. says that its main mission on Earth is to fight al-Qaeda, but then they arm al-Qaeda against countries that have never attacked the U.S.? You know, isn't this a contradiction too? So let's answer these two questions by looking at some general questions. You know, what's the status of U.S. power in the world today, and what factors is the U.S. dealing with, and what determines U.S. policy in a particular country? And I'll come back around to the main topic of the conference, which is drone warfare and the new tactics that the U.S. is using overall. So the first thing to understand is the United States, although it has the largest military ever assembled on Earth, is actually weaker than they were politically a generation ago. And there is a rising trend on Earth for greater independence from their control. The world has changed a lot since 9/11. You can express it in different ways, but the way I think of it is the camp of resistance is growing and U.S. influence is in decline. So the economic crisis gets part of the credit for that. Although the capitalists don't suffer like we do when there's an economic crisis, it has weakened their power and their prestige, that's not just here, but that's internationally. But even before the economic crisis, Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and the Cheney-Rumsfeld plan to go after, quote, Iraq, then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan, close quote, that had all been an effort by the U.S. to turn back the hands of time, to put the U.S. back on top the way they were when I was a kid in the 1950s and 60s. The wars in Iraq, you know, let's just be very clear on this. Those ended in defeats. I mean, we're still occupying Afghanistan, but that's currently a stalemate, and the United States is on its way to another loss there. So the most immediate clear lesson from those two debacles is the United States can't use the method of invasion anymore. Invasion and mass occupation, not really available to them as a military approach to countries that they don't like the leadership of. And the other thing that's emerged in this last month is, you know, with the role of Russia in the struggle over Syria, what we can see is that, you know, for 10 years, people have been talking about the rise of the BRIC nations, these rising economic powers that don't do everything the United States wants them to do. Well, pretty clearly, Russia has just done something the United States really doesn't want them to do. They've blocked in the UN Security Council. They've blocked their efforts to get a vote for this war. The other thing that's going against the U.S. is the U.S. Is the people of this country, the people of Britain, and the other members of NATO are sick of war. They're sick of being lied to. The transparency of the lies around chemical weapons use in Syria have just caused it's practically ubiquitous among public opinion in this country that people do not believe the president. So as a result, when he upped the ante in Syria, things came to a head, and Obama found himself isolated on the world stage and isolated here at home. So, So the sudden changes in the U.S. Plans around Syria, those are a result of contradictions. You know, first, the U.S. puppet the Free Syrian Army is losing to Syria's army and militia. Second, there's a contradiction between U.S. and Russia, which is no longer standing aside while the U.S. wages war. And third, there's a contradiction between the U.S. and its NATO allied governments and the peoples of those countries. Those contradictions came to a head in changing and forcing the U.S. to retreat. But again, let's remember that the U.S. objectives haven't changed. You know, this place is an empire. And, you know, what do they want? They want cheap labor, and they want cheap resources from these poorer countries. The United States, as Malcolm X said 50 years ago, is a vampire. They have to have it. It's not policy. It's their essence. They live by drinking the blood and labor of the peoples of this country and the world. So on the one hand, the U.S. is weaker and unable to get what they want. And on the other hand, they're compelled to keep trying. So for now, Rumsfeld's vision of invading Syria is gone. But the arming of al-Qaeda armies is not a contradiction. U.S. imperialism will back whoever and whatever serves its interests. In one country, al-Qaeda, they say, is the worst threat of humanity. In the next country, they're recipients of arms and intelligence to fight a government that the U.S. has determined must go. That's not a contradiction. That's just the different faces of U.S. foreign policy. Whatever time, place, and condition, they will back anyone to make an advance in their overall program. So now, you know, while the focus of the media has been on Syria, the focus of U.S. strategy is on Iran. All of the U.S. losses make them focus more and more on Iran. A new president there doesn't change that. The U.S. has adopted the stand toward Iran that they will not accept a regional power in the Middle East. Syria is aligned with Iran, and so the fate of those two countries is tied together in the view of the empire. I just want to talk 1 minute, too, about the Arab Spring, which is, for the United States, both a threat, but then also an opportunity. So right now, the U.S. can't handle a war on the scale of Iraq or greater than that. You know, Iran would be a much greater scale than the war in Iraq. That's why the U.S. was both anxious and excited by the Arab Spring. They used the dissatisfaction throughout the region, which was aimed squarely, initially, at their puppets in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in Bahrain. They went after the governments with a history of independence from them, Libya and Syria. The U.S. maneuvered to take control of the situation and develop contradictions in their favor in Libya. And with the success of their operation there, they felt they were in a better position to step up their attempts to topple the government of Syria. As in Libya, they offered support to the Islamists, even though supporting them in Libya resulted in some blowback, you know, in the attacks on the Western oil installations in Algeria and the U.S. embassy. So anyway, in summation, the U.S. seems to be acting in a contradictory way in Syria, but something unites their decisions in every action they take. Is it in the interests of U.S. imperialism? They want to go to war with Syria and Iran, but they don't have the support or the resources for an invasion. They want to bomb Syria, but they can't get support at home or in Britain, and more countries are standing up to them. They are willing to back any force against Assad, even though they worry about Israel, for example, being attacked by the mercenary armies they have created. So they've come up with new tactics. Invasions aren't popular. And they can't rely on the Arab Spring to emerge everywhere. So if you can't invade, how does an empire achieve its objectives of punishing independent people or rebellious populations? The answers they've come up with? Proxy armies, drone warfare, and special operations. Proxy armies are being used in Syria and before that in Libya. Drone warfare first emerged in use against Pakistan because the Pashtun people who live on both sides of the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan, that's been the main basis of national resistance on both sides of that border. So the Obama administration took that technology to Yemen and Somalia and Mali and Iran and probably countries that we don't even know about yet. We know that they intend to use it even more in the future because one growth area in the Pentagon's otherwise shrinking budget is the budget for drones. So in our work against U.S. wars, we have to stand against threats to arm puppet armies, to assassinate or back coups, to carry out bombing and missile attacks, and we have to oppose drone warfare as it is the most popular form of their undeclared wars. Thank you.